Tonight's reading will be taken from Daniel chapter 3, and that can be found on page 894. That's 894. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.' Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, 'Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music to fall down and worship the image I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?' Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.' Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace to be heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, 'Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?' They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see four men, unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered them and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
Sarah, thank you very much indeed for reading for us. And I add my welcome to Charlie's. It's great to see so many people here this evening. Now, our subject, as Charlie said this evening, is secularism and multiculturalism. And the question I want to answer is, does our society genuinely believe in multiculturalism? Once again, as with the rest of the series, we're going to go to the Bible, to God's Word, in order to understand our world. We're going to start in Daniel 3, then we shall have a little analysis of our society, and we will finish by asking from Daniel 3, how should we respond? Daniel 3 happens to be one of my favourite chapters in the whole of the Bible, so I'm really glad for us to be there. Daniel and his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, were Jews from the tribe of Judah. They were God's people. But as a result of their rejection of God, God had changed the political fortunes of Israel. They'd been invaded by the major superpower of the day, Babylon, and Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah had been deported, along with many of the finest young men of Judah in the 6th century BC. These teenage Jewish boys were educated in the pagan schools of Babylon. They were drafted into the Babylonian civil service, and their names were changed from names which reflected the glory of God, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, to names that were intended to speak of the majesty, so-called majesty of Babylonian gods. Belteshazzar was Daniel's name, Abednego, and so on. So in Daniel, we find God's... It's the way, incidentally, that all empires work. Look at the Soviet system. They deported and moved people around in order to extend their influence and crush other nations, and it happens all the way through history. So in Daniel, we find God's people living under the rule of Babylon, people who reject God. In Daniel, we find God's people outside the promised land, and in Daniel, we find out how it is that God's people are to live when God's people are in exile. It's a great book for us to study and be familiar with. If you've not read Daniel recently, good book to read. The New Testament refers to us as aliens and exiles in a foreign land. We're not yet in the promised land, and we live under pagan rulers in a world under God's judgment. Great to have a whole book of the Bible explaining how to live under the rule of pagan authorities. But at the same time, Daniel gives us a terrific insight into the way in which pagan rulers operate to secure their political and social power. Nowhere is that more clear than in Daniel 3 and Daniel 6, which takes us to our first point as we look at the way that pagan powers operate to secure their power. And I want us to look first at Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar, and the proud pretension of the pagan state. Great King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon was without doubt the most powerful and influential ruler of his day. He had all the military might of the United States, all the political muscle of Barack Obama, and all the financial clout and reach of a Bill Gates. Chapter 3 is made up of 7 panels. The central panel is chapter 4, verses 13 to 15. And the issue at stake is state-sponsored idolatry. What happens when the state overextends its God-given power and forces its citizens to bow to a state-sponsored idol? You can see that all the way through, because this image, you remember, as Sarah was reading, it was set up, was set up, was set up, was set up, was set up by King Nebuchadnezzar. And that stressed, you know, your English teacher would have been circling it in red, as I have done in my Bible. Not to criticize the author, of course, but just to show what the issue is, state-sponsored idolatry. Nebuchadnezzar sets up this massive totem pole, this massive idol. It's 90 feet high, it's 9 feet wide, it's made of gold, and it's set on the plain of Dura, verse 1 of chapter 3. There is no doubt about its purpose. Its purpose is to bring about the social and economic and political unity of the people of the Babylonian Empire, to declare the political, social superiority of that regime. At the plain of Dura is the place in Genesis 11 where the Tower of Babel was built. Again, a pretension of humanity over against God. And the text stresses not only the size of this golden image, we also see its aim in verses 2 and 3, and it's deliberately comical. So I'm going to read it to you, and I hope you will just be chuckling quietly to yourself. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you will fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And whoever doesn't fall down and worship shall be immediately cast into the burning fiery furnace." And therefore, as soon as the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, and so on and so on. Remember Court of King Caractacus with Rolf Harris singing it? And you probably don't remember it, but anyway, it was a great song. I've got its lyrics written down here, I think, somewhere. Now the fascinating witches who put the scintillating spitches in the breeches of the boys who put the powder on the nose of the face of the ladies of the harem of the Court of King Caractacus were just passing by and so on. Sorry, I didn't commit it to my memory. I think, though it is not very kind of me to mention this, that in the ITV advertisement, the McDonald's in the World Cup adverts, I think that's drawing on the Court of King Caractacus, and you should think of Daniel 3 when you hear it. Well, what is the purpose of this vast man-made idol? Well, it's spelled out, isn't it, that when they hear the sound of the horns, the trigon, and all the rest of it, they're to bow down and worship. Now, I love it, because the people of Israel, exiled in Babylon, are a repressed minority, politically, economically, spiritually subjugated. Daniel has told us that it's God who brought about the exile from Israel. There's no doubt who's in charge. But it looks as if King Nebuchadnezzar rules the roost. And you can imagine the people of Israel sitting in their kind of huts by the banks of the Chebar River on the canal there, rolling around as they tell this story and laugh at the impotence of man-made idolatry. Who are the satraps, prefects, governors, counselors, treasurers, justices, magistrates, and officials? Why, this is the gathering of all the establishment ruling elite from all the nations of the Babylonian Empire. This is the G20. Here are the prime ministers and presidents of the wealthiest nations. Here is Angela Merkel, Mr. Berlusconi, Barack Obama. Oh, and there's the new boy, Dave, with his puppet. Here are the treasurers and the chancellors of those nations. Here are the judges and the magistrates, the CEOs of the world-leading international financial institutions, and they come in their droves with their limousines and private jets, their aides and their advisors, their flunkies, their wives, girlfriends, and mistresses, quite a few in the case of Mr. Berlusconi. And what do they do on the plain of Jura in the province of Babylon? At the sound of the horn, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, they bow down to a lump of gold. My grandparents used to have a music box. Some of you may remember those things, sort of thing you entertained yourself with before the days of, shooting each other on the video games. And you would wind it up. It was a wooden box, a beautifully carved thing. You'd wind it up. You'd open it out. There was a glass mirror on the bottom, a mechanism then moving a magnet around, and you took two little kind of, it must have had some metal in them, figures, statuettes, and they danced like pre-programmed automata around the music box. Here are the most influential, powerful, intelligent, reasonable individuals in the greatest empire of the ancient world, and they dance like brain-dead automata to the tune of man-made idolatry. It's pathetic, isn't it? Well, panel one is meant to be side-splittingly hilarious. Panel two takes a more sinister turn. We're not going to look at all of the panels. I just want to introduce you to man-made idolatry. Verse 8 is very important. For at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. The Chaldeans were the astrologers, magicians and sorcerers of the Babylonian Empire. They are the futurologists. They advise the king on his policies. They are the focus group conveners, the policy makers, the think tank gurus, and the media manipulators. No decision was ever taken without consulting them. And in a culture that denies the existence of a living, active, true God, creator of the universe, inevitably these people assume extraordinary powers because people don't know how to live. They're terrified about the future. They don't know the living God who controls all things in his sovereignty. And so these futurologists assume extraordinary power. But in chapter 2, they've been shown to be impotent. And Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had been promoted above them. So these guys in verse 8 have got they bear a grudge, they have a chip on their shoulder, and an axe to grind. God's people obviously can't bow down to a state-sponsored idol. Of course you can't. There's only one God, and you must worship him. Nebuchadnezzar has hopelessly overextended his powers. But seeing God's people refusing to bow down, the Chaldeans seize their opportunity to revenge and take their chance to put the God-botherers in their place. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever." They're real little greasers, aren't they? "You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound," and so on, "and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning..." "There are certain Jews," verse 12, "whom you have appointed over the affairs." You can just hear it, can't you? And it's always the ones with the most to lose who squeal the loudest when it comes to the Christian witness. Panel three. The sinister intrigue of the Chaldeans provokes what they wanted in Nebuchadnezzar: furious rage. Verse 13. It's precisely how the powerful in Babylon are expected to react. The denial of the one true living God inevitably means that men and women draw powers to themselves that they have no right to hold. They think they're the only power. And they draw powers that they have no right. And they, in their delusion, they think that those powers bring about social cohesion and political union and enable people to move freely around the world because they've established these great institutions. And of course, when people refuse to bow down, they respond in fury, absolute fury. Because you God-botherers, are threatening the social cohesion, the political union of the empire. What are we going to do if we've got a group of people who won't bow down to this great state-sponsored idol? And therefore, like pre-programmed automata, having had their politically correct lobotomies, they march onto the plains of Dura, and at the blast of the horn, they bow down. Here is the CEO of a large multinational corporation. Here's the head teacher of a secularist school. Here is the chancellor of a university. Here is the Lord Chief Justice. And they come together to the beat of the drum and the decree of the emperor. And like Victorian music box playthings, they bow. And of course, because their idolatry is carried out in the name of social cohesion, political unity, any challenge to it is considered to be a challenge to the whole well-being of the empire. And thus, all the powers of the empire are brought to bear on those who challenge it. Well, let's turn now from the state, Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, and the proud pretense of the pagan powers, noticing that it is those who have most to lose who squeal the loudest when people stand up and challenge the inappropriate powers of the empire. Let's turn now to the West, secularism, multiculturalism, and the dangerous deceit of diversity. It's time for some definitions. I've written out some little headings on the back of the notice sheet, and I want you to concentrate hard on this section. It's the more complex part, and we need to get our head around one or two ideas. First of all, secular. Secular is a word taken from the Latin secularis, meaning of this age. The English word secular is a 13th century word, meaning of this world. Anything that has to do with the affairs of this world is secular. It's right to say that human government is secular. Your school is secular, if you happen to be at a school or university. Our legal system is secular. Many aspects of the church are secular, of the world, organizational, just the way we organize ourselves, secular. Secularism is altogether different. Secularism is a 19th century movement, atheistic in its origin, and it developed in the middle of the 19th century, and its origin is associated with two guys, George Holyoake and Charles Bradlaugh. Between them, they founded the London Secular Society, which technically is a misuse of the word secular, but we won't go into that now. Secularism has as its goal the organization and development of human life and society without reference to eternity or to God. Okay, secularism has as its goal the organization of human life and society without reference to God. To quote Holyoake, the existence of a future life as well as the existence of God belong to the debatable ground of speculation. And therefore, any public debate for the secularist must be conducted without reference to my personal beliefs or convictions that stem from my understanding of the divine, because to the secularist, you can't have that. It's an atheistic system. Society should be organized without reference to the divine. Now, of course, anyone who's got half a mind awake will spot the problem with the ideology. If the existence of a future life and the existence of God belong to the debatable ground of speculation, then the non-existence of God or a future life also belong to the debatable ground of speculation. Secularism is a faith position. I happen to believe it's unscientific, unhistorical, and extraordinarily bad for society. But it's just as much a faith position to deny the existence of God and organize your life as if he's not there, deciding what is good and what is bad on the understanding that there is no God, as it is a faith position to accept the existence of God and organize your life and society as if there is a God. Both are faith positions. Now, immediately you can see the inbuilt logical flaw with secularism, and the inbuilt exercise in an abuse of power on the part of some secularists. I believe there is no God. You believe there is a God. I will silence you by declaring your views illegitimate and not allowing you to speak openly. Now, following its emergence in the 19th century, secularism gained ground with immense speed. With the decline of Western churches and the advance of modernism, secularists genuinely believed in the 1960s and 70s that in the modern world, religion would die out. They genuinely believed it. Peter Berger was one of the chief sociologists arguing for secularism in the 60s and 70s. Listen to his analysis. Although the term secularization theory refers to works from the 50s and 60s, the key idea can be traced to the Enlightenment. The idea is simple. Modernization necessarily leads to a decline of religion, both in society and the minds of individuals. And that's exactly what Berger was arguing in his books in the 60s and 70s. You can go and read them. Here is Peter Berger writing in 1997. I think what I and most other sociologists of religion wrote in the 1960s about secularization was a mistake. Our underlying argument was that secularization and modernity go hand in hand. With more modernization comes more secularization. It wasn't a crazy theory. There was some evidence for it, but I think it's basically wrong. Most of the world today is certainly not secular. That's a misuse of the term. It's very religious. And Rodney Stark, who quotes Berger, says this: after nearly three centuries of utterly failed prophecies and misrepresentation of present and past, it seems time to carry the secularization doctrine to the graveyard of failed theories and there to whisper, rest in peace. But religion hasn't died out. And many secularists today still play their power game and seek to organize society without reference to the eternal, without reference to the existence of God. We see it most plainly, don't we, in public debate. And just recently, here is the chairman, president of the National Secular Society, Terry Sanderson, writing about the goings-on in the House of Lords. The Tories are obviously of the opinion that the bishops have some unique insight that can inform their policy making. As a nation, we've outgrown religion, and we don't want it back. Now, do you see the abuse of power there? It is assumed that anyone with a faith position is inevitably biased and cannot have anything useful to say in the organization of society, apart from the secularist. And the secularist's faith position must be accepted by everybody. And woe betide you if you seek to express other faith views in public. You should be silenced. Of course, the idea that there can be a naked public square in which all beliefs about what is right and wrong and good for society are excluded is an absurd idea. And the attempts to organize a school or a university or a country or an office according to my own secularist faith position by barring anyone else who believes something different from the public square is just an exercise in gagging the opposition. It is one of the most cynical acts of censorship imaginable by the secularists, by some secularists. Bow down to my golden image that I have set up, and don't you dare speak up. How then do some secularists seek to organize society when it's made up of highly mobile populations with very different religious ideas and social practices? Answer: through multiculturalism. Time for two more definitions. So tune in if you're finding it a bit warm. Sorry about that, I can't help you. Tune in and concentrate for the next few minutes for a couple more definitions. Culture, or culture, is the total range of activities and ideas of any group of people with shared traditions and belief. That's culture. Activities and ideas of any group of people with shared traditions and belief. There are huge numbers of wonderful and glorious things about pretty much every human culture. I mean, I hope, like me, you admire, delight in, and rejoice over German culture with its precision, organization, ruthless efficiency, and will to win. I hope you enjoy things like the World Cup, the Olympics, and the sort of open celebration of human culture. It's wonderful to see the inventiveness of humanity, our artistic abilities, our imagination, our diversity. It is a wonderful, and I love traveling. I love living in London as you see all these cultures gathered together with different ways of doing things. It's a reflection of the rich diversity and inventiveness of a glorious creator. However, because cultures are human things, every culture is flawed. Every aspect of every culture is touched to greater or lesser extent by human sin. Human culture is not necessarily as flawed as it could be, and we've seen through time, haven't we, some more flawed cultures than others. But every aspect of every human culture is flawed. Culture. Multiculturalism is a political doctrine that emerged in our generation in 1965 in Canada. Sorry if you're Canadian, that's where it came from. So we're going to talk about it for just a moment. We love your culture, most of your culture. Multiculturalism emphasizes the diversity of human culture and speaks of itself with these tremendous words, equality, inclusiveness, and the celebration of diversity. Let me quote from a Canadian political document. Canadian multiculturalism is fundamental to our beliefs that all citizens are equal. Multiculturalism ensures that all citizens can keep their identities, take pride in their ancestry, and have a sense of belonging. Great. Diversity is one of the key words, buzzwords, of multiculturalism. Good. With globalization and a huge amount of mass movement of people, multiculturalism has become highly popular. And the Commission on the Future of Multi-Ethnic Britain in 2000 had this to say: Britain is both a community of citizens and a community of communities, both a liberal and a multicultural society. The trouble is that no nation and no region, no small community, ever is in reality truly multicultural. We all hold beliefs and frame laws that render some aspects of some cultures either illegal or socially beyond the pale in our view. That's how we organize things. Let me give you some examples. January 1999, pretty much most of us were alive in January, I think all of us were alive in January 1999, and Glenn Hoddle, I'm sorry to come back to this, oh dear, I hadn't thought of the demise actually when I should have, shows inadequacy, but Glenn Hoddle was then coach of the England football team. He held Hindu beliefs, you may remember, but he made the terrible error of expressing those beliefs publicly in multicultural Britain when he said at a conference that disabled people suffered from their disabilities as a direct consequence of either their or their parents' sin. Now, personally, I think those views are odious. I think they're wrong, and it's an aspect of Hindu culture that is a horrible thing. However, they are fundamental to Hindu faith, and they're held by literally hundreds of millions of people, tens of millions of people around the world. In fact, millions of people in Britain believe what Glenn Hoddle expressed publicly. On January the 30th or 31st, Tony Blair spoke publicly against Glenn Hoddle, and on the 2nd of February he was sacked. Multicultural? Liberal tolerance? Well, hardly. All citizens are equal? Oh yes, all citizens are equal apart from Glenn Hoddle and quite a few million others who think the same way as him. They're not equal at all. Multicultural? Here's another example. In March 2010, Jacob Zuma visited Great Britain. Zuma has five wives, you probably know. He brought with him his most recently acquired wife, Tabika Madiba. He also has numerous mistresses and at least one child born out of wedlock. When confronted by some sections of the British media as to his lifestyle, he responded, "You are attacking my Zulu culture." But Jacob Zuma, were he a British citizen, would be locked up for polygamy. All citizens can keep their identities, can take pride in their ancestry and have a sense of belonging. Oh, yeah, everybody apart from those with a Zulu culture and actually about 11 million Muslims whose Islamic law suggests that they should be allowed to have four wives. Multicultural? So we could go on and on, couldn't we? The point is that multiculturalism is a new political doctrine that pretends to be what it is not, using all sorts of right-on labels like diversity, tolerance, equality, in order to pretend that everybody is free to practice their culture in our liberal society, and unable, because it's formed by liberals, to criticize any society as wrong or sinful or something the matter with it, because we believe everything's good and there's no such thing as sin, and therefore making kind of arbitrary rules that exclude lots of people and actually create monocultural Britain, secularist monoculture. No culture is truly multicultural. I mean, come on. We don't allow Druids to sacrifice their babies. They ought to. I mean, I have some come across some people who call themselves Druids. They're not really Druids at all. They're pathetic excuses for Druids. Druids are meant to sacrifice their babies. But they don't. I'm jolly glad they don't. We're not multicultural, though, are we? However, we do have literally tens of thousands of babies sacrificed in our country every year in our clinics. And that's allowed by the secularist faith system, which I think is odious and utterly wrong, and I hope you do too. But it's illegal in many countries of the world. So we're not really multiculturalists. We frame laws that reflect our beliefs in order to establish a framework where cultures can coexist up to a point. And through our beliefs, we recognize that some things are bad and some things are good. And so we impose the values of our faith system upon the citizens of a nation through a legal system that comes about as a result of our open discussion of what is right and what is good and what is wrong. Well, that's fine, the open discussion and the framing of laws. But some secularists, in their ardent, you might say, fundamentalist pursuit of their faith system, under the cover of multiculturalism that sounds so diverse, with the claims to equality and liberality, seek to ban the freedom of speech, both by ejecting certain people from the public square, you can't bring faith into the Houses of Parliament, or by refusing to allow some people to speak at all. Now, I don't need to rehearse that to you. You work in offices where freedom of speech is banned, and you work for government health organizations and education institutions that are illiberal, secularist, and not prepared to allow you to speak freely and openly. I don't need to tell you that. This Wednesday, I had lunch with three business guys, one a senior city law firm partner, another working a Japanese shipper, and the other a younger lawyer, and each one spoke of incidents in the last 5 years where they'd been summoned to give account and reprimanded for things that they had said to colleagues about Jesus. Multicultural, liberal diversity? No. Illiberal, intolerant, secularist fundamentalism. This is not multiculturalism or liberal diversity. It is totalitarian. And let me say, it is exceedingly dangerous. I don't think you even begin to realize how dangerous it is, because you've been brought up to bow down to the idol. It is exceedingly dangerous. Because in your secularist fundamentalism, you secularist fundamentalist, you ban from the public sphere the possibility of discussing and openly criticizing and weighing and condemning the relative value and truth claims and moral values as to what is good and bad in the different religions and no religion. And if you do that, even as secularism is on the decline, and even as religions are on the increase, you make it impossible for people to say, oh, actually, we think that is wrong, sinful, bad for society, bad for people, and untrue. And that is a very, very dangerous position for a culture to end up in. And yet the brainwashed automata of the liberal establishment march, almost zombie-like, with their politically correct ideals towards the idol of Western secularism and bow down. Here is a head teacher who proudly presides over a secularist school. She will not allow the discussion of the relative merits and truth claims of one religion over another or over no religion to take place in assembly on the grounds of diversity and multiculturalism. She is, of course, enforcing a secularist monoculture on her school that is illiberal and intolerant. And when the band strikes up, her pupils are expected to dance to the tune of Western secularism. What if a group of pupils refuse to bow down and call the bluff of their illogical secularist power plays? Oh, they may not be thrown into the fiery furnace. The secularists haven't quite got that far yet. But you can be sure that they will face opposition. Here's the dean of a Cambridge college. The students are organising a mission to explain and openly public promote the truths of the Christian faith. They're knocking on the doors of their fellow students or offering them a copy of Mark's gospel. And the dean of the college, on the grounds of diversity, bans the handing out of gospels. Here is the HR section of the National Health, the hospital, the education system. And somebody speaks to a patient or a friend or a colleague about the truth claims of Christianity, and they're summoned to the HR department. Well, finally, we're out of time. How are Christians to respond in Babylon when the powers of Babylon demand that they bow down? And the answer is there in the central panel, verse 16, which I'm going to read. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Why not? Because there's a God in heaven. Because that God in heaven reveals, actually in chapter 7, that he has given all rule and authority to the Son of Man. That Jesus Christ comes claiming to be the Son of Man and demonstrates his position of rule and authority through his death and resurrection on the cross. And God exalts Jesus to the highest place so that as our Creator and Lord and King, Jesus has every right to the full worship and obedience of every single one of us in this room. And as we come to Jesus and we hear from our God what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is bad, so the rich diversity of human culture can flourish under the authority of the one true and living God. So what is our message to the world? Our message to the world is, as you seek to ban Christians from speaking of the gospel of Jesus Christ, you are not responsible, liberal, intelligent, tolerant, multiculturalists. Quite the reverse. You are acting the way pagan despots always have acted, with intolerance, illiberality, and fundamentalist desires to create a monoculture. Our message to one another: God is able to save. As we bow down to him who has absolute power, we have confidence to stand up and continue proclaiming the gospel. Wherever you are, whatever the boss or the authorities say, nobody has the right to silence you. And all over the world, other Christians are standing up in illiberal, totalitarian regimes. And as some secularists seek to create that sort of regime in your office and in your hospital, you and I must stand up and continue to declare that Jesus Christ is Lord and King. Now we're going to finish there. Time for questions. Charlie, I think, is going to run our question time.
On the basis of what you've been saying, does this mean that we as Christians should maybe get alongside other faith groups to stand for the right of all faiths to be able to express the faith?
Should we get alongside other faith groups and stand up for the right of all faiths to express what they believe freely? There is absolutely no reason why we shouldn't be what technically is known as co-belligerent with people who want to insist on the freedom of speech. Yeah, absolutely. There's no reason why we shouldn't. But we need to be very clear. When you say get alongside, I'm not particularly in favour of that language, because we need to be very clear. Remember the talk on Islam 2 weeks ago, that Jesus Christ claims to be Lord of every other religious movement and idea. Only he's risen from the dead. You know, no other religious leader has ever risen, made the kind of claims he made. So, but being co-belligerent, no reason why in a society like ours we shouldn't.
Question: what's distinctively secular about that shutting down of voices? So wouldn't traditional Christian cultures have wanted to criticise Zuma and Hoddle? What's secularist about the way it's done?
Well, the secularist, it's when some secularists, I was very careful to say, when some secularists seek to create a playing field on which you cannot express religious ideas. So the thing that I'm arguing against there, and I think where the secularist takes the power of a Nebuchadnezzar to themselves, is where they start saying, you can't speak openly, criticise and so on. So remember what I said, cultures, all cultures are sinful. All cultures have wonderful, most cultures have glorious things we want to celebrate. I mean, all cultures have aspects of wonderful things we want to celebrate. But all cultures are sinful, and we need to be able to, under the rule of the sovereign God, criticise and, you know, openly discuss and talk about it. So the problem comes when a secularist starts to say, I won't allow you to do that. On the grounds of my faith, and that's where the problem arises.
Okay, so two questions: should we campaign against secularism, monoculturalism? Should we try and fight it, or is that just leave that and get on with witnessing to Jesus?
I mean, I think we should get on and witness to be clear on the truth, the historical truth of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and then you will find secularism dissipating. But there will be some clashes. And we may find, no reason why we should, but we may find, maybe in a period where Babylon is going to be dominant, you know, and secularism will be there for the next however long. But we will find, as we, you know, the sixth formers were in here at 4 o'clock. They heard this talk, and, you know, I thought of the sixth formers in schools where the headmasters and headmistresses are seeking to create secularist. I mean, they're not sensible enough to work out the difference between secular and secularist. So they say, we want to be a secular school. All schools are secular. You know, get your grammar right. So you're meant to be a headmaster. So, but what they're trying to do is create secular. I mean, Latimer School, for example, wanting to create a very secularist environment. No religious ideas allowed in the public. That's just totalitarian. That's what one of the leading schools in London is seeking to do.
So the question wants to push you harder. Do you then want a totalitarian Christian government?
No, absolutely not. There's a great document produced by Theos, which is an organisation in politics called How We Do Government, or something like that. It's a short document, take you about 20 minutes to read. If anybody in the political realm here, you need to read it. You ought to push it around your political friends. What we want is a kind of, I hope this doesn't confuse, sort of Christian. We want an open playing field, put it like that. So we want to be able to allow people to express their ideas, and then we will frame laws following an open discussion. We will always be countercultural as Christians, but what we don't want is the kind of censorship of some secularists as they seek to. And Parliament is like that. It's very interesting. The Bishop of London was speaking the other day on just the derision with which the bishops are treated in the House of Lords by a significant number of people, as if when they stand up, you know, how can you have anything to say to this? Because you're speaking from a faith position. And I suspect the same is true at work. You know, if you were to say in your bank, actually, I think for Christian reasons, this is a foolish way to operate, you know, taking on 3,000 people and then laying off 2,000. You know, it may make sense to an economic materialist, but actually, it's not a clever way to do business. And I'm saying that for Christian reasons. I expect you to be laughed at court. You may not be, but.
And what's the right way to respond then? So a question worrying this just leads to some sort of war with secularism. Someone else thinks you're exaggerating. How do we not just end up as another embattled minority, worried and defensive and fighting?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I don't think I am over-exaggerating if you look at what has happened in our culture with the kind of things that have gone on in some institutions recently. People wearing, you know, a few instances, people wearing crosses. Go tomorrow into your office, and when you're at the water cooler, say, I am an open follower of Jesus Christ, and Jesus commands all the people at this water cooler, did you know that, to submit to his rule. And he declares ways of life that are not clearly biblical to be sinful. How do you think you would get on in your office? Try it. If you think I'm over-exaggerating, go and do it. I mean, I really hope you will, in a gracious, sensitive way. Now, I don't want us to be on the back foot defensive. I mean, the reason I've spoken so strongly is because I think Daniel 3 is ridiculing pagan idolatry. That's why I've used the kind of strong terminology I've used, because I think it fits with the sense of the passage. It is a ridiculing of pagan idolatry. And when you look at the position of some secularists, it is ridiculous to claim that you're liberal and do all these things. So I think that's fair. But when you're in your... If you're dean, for example, imagine you're at King's College and the dean in Cambridge, and the dean said to you halfway through a mission, that's enough handing out of Mark's Gospels. Really, we're a diverse college, and you're not allowed to do that anymore. I think I would be encouraging you, well, I know I'd be encouraging you, to say to the dean, well, I'm sorry, dean, you have no right... you are the dean, actually, you're meant to be a Christian, but you have no right under God to prevent me from speaking. I would say to him, well, hang on, I think you're actually, I think, challenging my human rights here. And I think I would go along those lines. If I was in an office and the HR department forbade me from speaking openly about Jesus and inviting people to Christian meetings and sharing the gospel with people, not in time when I'm meant to be being paid, but in a sort of reasonable way over a drink or what have you, and the HR department said, I think I'd take them and talk about human rights and human freedom and freedom of speech, and say, well, I think you're beyond your remit at this point.
And if threatened for doing that, what would be your response?
My response would be that people all over the world are being threatened by totalitarian regimes, and we must learn to stand up. I mean, I remember going to my commanding officer in the army. He'd commanded me to do something that was wrong for a Christian to do. And I remember as a young captain going and saying, I'm sorry, Colonel, I will not do that. If you command me to do that, I will have to disobey you. Now, you're going to have to learn to do that. You know, think of the Chinese. They're having to do that in their thousands. And the worst they can do, well, the worst they can do is kill you. I think that's unlikely in our culture. But the worst they can do is sack you. Actually, you will find if they sack you that the law is on your side because they are threatening your human rights. But the worst they can do is sack you. I mean, and Jesus says in Luke's gospel that anybody who is ashamed of him in this generation, he will be ashamed of them when he comes in his glory. Now, which would you rather? Face the rejection of your peers or face the disapproval of God Almighty? I know which I'd rather do.
I think probably leave it there. There's lots of other questions which I think it'd be good to take up over food later.
Can I set a question? Yeah, could you please, when we finish, turn to your neighbour and say to them, do you think our culture is monocultural or multicultural? And then as a Christian, if you are a Christian, how should we respond? Okay, could you set, I'm setting you some, you've asked me some questions, only fair, I'm asking you some.
Thank you, William. Thank you, everyone who's sent a question. Please stay, there is food afterwards where William will be. Be a chance to carry on talking about that, asking questions.